year more than me. And I remember being with him. We were in Chicago for a family function, and he was sober, I think about a year. Yeah, he was about a year sober. And I asked him, I said, you know, what's this deal with you not drinking? And he said, well, you know, you actually started me on this. I'm like, huh? What do you mean? And he said, well, we got together like a year ago, and you had stopped drinking for like 3 months. And I had kind of forgotten about that, but there was like a three-month period where I didn't drink, and I got together with my brother, who I hadn't seen for years, and we went out to a bar, and I said, I guess I'll have a drink. And he was like, what do you mean? I said, well, I haven't had a drink for like 3 months, you know. So I was doing that totally, you know, self-will, and I don't know how I do know how I made it through it. I used some dry substances that you smoke, and, you know, that was the deal. And he said to me, he said, you got me started on it. And I was like, wow. But he said, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, I can stop drinking. And he goes, I said, I can stop drinking just like I used to. And he said, well, what do you do when you stop drinking? And I said, well, I smoke pot, you know. And he said, look, he says, it's the same thing. It's, you're numbing your feelings. And I didn't understand that. I had no idea what feelings were. I just no concept of that. During my childhood, I was in several car crashes, bad accidents, never got hurt. When I was 10 years old, I was in a plane crash, a small single-engine plane crash. And my father was very verbally abusive. After I had like a year sober, I went to my sponsor with some problems, and he said, you know, I can't really help you with this. You need to see somebody professional. So I did. I went to somebody, and it talks about that in the big book, that sometimes we need to see somebody professional. And I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. And that whole discovery and the discussions with therapists, that really helped a lot as far as me figuring out like where my brain was, because I would do what they call dissociate, which is where, you know, you can be here but your brain is somewhere else. And I did that like throughout my childhood and through school. When I was in high school, I didn't go to class really hardly ever. I got thrown out of high school couple times. I got thrown out of public high school. Basically, my goal there was to be an entrepreneur. I was selling drugs. You know, I didn't go to class. They had this new thing they had just introduced at the high school, which was open campus. It was kind of like they wanted it to be like a college campus. And I figured out right away that I could go to my homeroom, get marked as present, and not go to classes the rest of the day. And I did that for quite a while until my folks got a phone call and they said, you know, you got to take your son out of the school because he's not going to class. So I got sent to a boarding school, and my choice, the way I chose the boarding school is there was a friend of mine that I had hung out with going to that school, and, you know, he drank, I had drank with him, so, you know, that was like, oh, I want to go to that school because there's somebody I know there and somebody that I can drink with. Started drinking probably was about 12. Back when I was a kid, the drinking age was 18. So I pretty much, you know, I thought I was like obeying the law while I was doing drugs. I'm sorry, the drugs are part of my story. I know this is AA, but I was doing drugs up until I was 18. And then when I was legally allowed to drink, I started drinking more heavily. I didn't drink much before I was 18. I came to Florida when I was 20. I just wanted to get away from my family. So I moved out of the house when I was 18. I lived in a variety of places. But I came to Florida when I was 20. There was a guy in North Miami that I had gone to school with up north. And he said, you know, if things don't work out, come down here. So I came down here. It was 1976. And this place was a lot different then. I had an apartment we had an apartment together, like about five blocks from here, and this whole area was quite a bit different back then. I got a job at a hotel on the beach, and I started there as like a janitor. The painter was a drunk, so the manager fired him, and I said, oh, I can paint. I hadn't hardly painted anything, but he gave me the painter job, and then I got a bellhop job, and I just kind of worked my way up, and I was doing front desk work. I was there for 7 years, but the guys that made the most money, I would see them every night when I was working the front desk. They'd come down after 2 o'clock after closing down the bar. The bartenders would have a big bottle full of money, you know, so I was like, I think I can tend bar. I want to tend bar, you know. And that was probably one of my downfalls, because part of tending bar, you know, is that you go out and drink too, you know. I mean, you get out. I would drink at work. They kind of allowed it. Like, if there was a hotel guest, you could buy him a drink, and you'd have a drink with him, you know. So, you know, we would go out after work. And just, it was just a nonstop party. I lived on the beach. I had always had apartments on the beach. Back then, you could get apartments really cheap, like a little efficiency place in one of the hotels a couple blocks off the beach. And always just hung out with people that drank, and it was a party life. You know, that was when they had spring break here. It was just wild. And it was a lot of fun, you know. It didn't really stop being fun until... Eventually, I got some other jobs and got into the retail business. Then I was working at a bank, and I was always a functional alcoholic. I don't have like a really low bottom. I've always worked all my life. I started working before I was old enough to work legally. I would lie about my age, and I always worked, and I always managed to manage my alcoholism. You know. They talk about, you know, our life is unmanageable, and I'm like, my life is manageable. I'm managing it. I'm managing my alcoholism. And then I realized after I got sober how insane my thinking was, that my life revolved around figuring out when I got out of work, where I was going to get my next drink, how much I needed for the weekend. If there was like a holiday weekend, I had to figure out exactly what stuff I needed to have in the house so that I didn't have to go out and driving a lot. I did have one DUI. I only got in trouble with the law once when I was 20 years old. It was a payday. It was a Friday. And it was back when I was working at the hotel on the beach. And one of the guys said, let's go out, cash our checks, and go to the bar. We went to the Parrot Lounge, the world-famous Parrot Lounge. And proceeded to just drink our brains out, you know. And we got thrown out because there was like one of those hot dog machines there, and the hot dog was spinning probably all day long. And I decided I was hungry and wanted to eat this thing. It was nasty, and it came right up, and I didn't even go to the bathroom. It was just all over the bar. And Tim, who now owns the place, but he was the bartender back then, he brings out a bucket and a mop and says, you guys got to clean this up. And my friend saw the bucket and felt like he had to go to the bathroom. And it was bad, you know. So Tim threw us out. We went back in, he threw us out again, and I got in my car and decided to drive across town to see a friend of mine to see if I could cop something. And ran into somebody across town who said, Eric, you're really drunk. You shouldn't be driving. You need to go home. But, you know, I had to get in my car and drive home. And hit a telephone pole on right down the street here on the intersection of... Sistrunk and Andrews. I was coming down Sistrunk, and because I lived like four blocks from here. And the light was changing, so I gunned the engine, and the lane changes from like two lanes to one, but I didn't realize it, and I hit the telephone pole. And about 10 years after that, I met the cop that arrested me. I was working at a retail store, and he came in the shop, and I saw his badge, and I said, "Your name looks really familiar." And he remembered. It was like 10 years later. He goes, "Yeah, I arrested you." I was like, okay. Yeah, you did. And he said, "I can't believe that you got out of the car and stood up after you hit the telephone pole." He said, "I thought I was calling the mortician that you were going to be dead." They took me to the hospital, the Broward General, and they stitched, I had a cut in my chin, and they stitched it. And then they take me over the window to sign out, you know, and I thought everything was fine, and all of a sudden I had cuffs on, you know. I was like, "What's up with this?" And they're like, "You're going to jail." I'm like, "Okay, great." So in jail, fortunately, nobody messed with me because I was pretty beat up, and, you know, there was guys in there that had, the dogs had gotten out on them, and, you know, they were chewed up more than me, but nobody messed with me. And then I had to go to, back then it was like a slap on the wrist. It was like a $500 fine, and I had to go to this DUI school where basically they taught you how much you could drink without getting into trouble. You know, there was no, they didn't say, "Hey, you know, maybe you have a problem with alcohol." There was none of that discussion about, you know, there's AA for people like you, things like that. There was none of that. It was just, you weigh this much, you can drink this much. I was like, okay, I can do that. The reason my life is so amazing now is about, you know, I work the steps. I have a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor for over 10 years, and I work the steps, and I go to a lot of meetings, and I always prayed. I had what I thought was God in my life, but about 3 years ago, I was on a spiritual retreat. I started going to men's spiritual retreats. They were in Lantana at a place called the Cenacle. Now they're in Delray at the Duncan Center twice a year, and I always go whenever I can. And about 3 years ago, one of the people leading the retreat was a gentleman who spoke here just recently, Russell Spatz. And I don't know how many of you know Russell, have heard him, but he can give a very convincing argument. He's a defense attorney, and he can convince pretty much anybody of anything, I believe. And he gave a very convincing argument about the way God is presented in the Big Book. And he talked about going to church and getting into the Bible. And I grew up Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed when I was 13. And that's really the last thing I had anything to do with any kind of thought about God or anything like that. You know, after that, I started with the drinking and all the other stuff. And, you know, Russell made me realize that I didn't have contempt for things like going to church or checking out synagogues or any of that, but I hadn't done any research in that area. And after that weekend, Stevie B said to me, "You know, you might want to check out church. We go to church." And I thought, okay, I'll do that. I'll try it. I'm open-minded enough to try it. And since then, amazing things have happened. You know, I would go to meetings, and, you know, I'd get together and go to the diner and stuff like that with the people, but didn't really have what I would consider true friends and fellowship in the program. And once I started establishing a routine of reading the Bible and getting into spiritual things and praying more and getting together with people that follow that path, I had amazing fellowship and friendships start. Right now, at my home group, I send out text messages from my BlackBerry. And BlackBerries are amazing. You can put like 150 people in there. And I got like 100, forget about the iPhone. I got like 120 phone numbers in my phone for guys from my home group in the program. And I send out text messages. You know, if somebody's speaking somewhere, we send out a text message. Somebody has a problem, needs help, we send out a text message. And I find that I get phone calls from guys all the time. I call other guys in the program. in the big book, it says that He, with a capital H, will give you the fellowship you crave. And it's really been proven to be true in my life. And it just amazes me where my life has gone. You know, I've had a lot of struggles in sobriety. I think my life was way easier before I got sober. In sobriety, I've gotten divorced. My financial situation got so bad that I had to talk to numerous bankruptcy attorneys and thought, okay, I'll file bankruptcy and I'll be out of the woods. Well, I didn't qualify for bankruptcy, so I had to like find another way to get out of my jackpot that I totally got into during sobriety, you know, just not living responsibly and you know, some of the things were beyond my control, were related to my divorce, but still, it all happened, and I had to get through it. And more importantly, I didn't drink, and I just owe that all to this program and all the wonderful friendships I have now. Thank you.
Easy. My alcoholic name is Doug, and thank you so much, Eric. And our next speaker, I've got to know quite well since March 30th of 2007 is when I first met him. At a treatment center I was in, he was bringing a meeting in, and to tell you the truth, I couldn't stand the guy when I first met him. And he was so happy, and he seemed like he knew what he was doing, and I figured a guy can't be this happy, and can't have such a life beyond his wildest dreams, as he says. And then I got to know him, and it's true. And he's helping me to take that same route, and that's Stevie B. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. My name is Stevie B, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Stevie.
And a proud member of the West Side Men's Group.
Nice.
It's so good to be here with you guys tonight. You know, some people don't understand about the... Well, actually, I don't understand about the nice, so I don't want to try to defend that, but it is really nice being a member of a home group and having men, for myself, it's men, that show up for you on a night like this. If I could just ask all the members of our home group just to raise your hand. So it's pretty nice, right? Isn't that incredible? And a lot has to do with Texter, which was Eric Steinberg that was just up here before. That's actually his real name, Eric Texter Steinberg. And he sends out a text and lets people know that we're speaking or that there's events going on. And because we want to support each other, because we love this way of life, there's no place in the world that we would rather be on a Saturday night. Talking about God, talking about friendship, talking about what's happened in our lives. Today he sent out a text message because one of our members of our home group passed away yesterday. And he passed away not sober. And he has three little babies, one 5 or 4, one 2, and one 10 months. And he has a beautiful wife, and he lives in a beautiful home. And on Thursday night, which is the night of our home group at 7:30, he made a decision. The decision was that he was going to go to the home group, and then he decided not to go to the home group. And now his family has to bury him. You see, the reason that I take this thing so seriously, but I don't take myself so seriously, is because 9 years ago, around the corner from here, I almost died. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 22 years old. I stayed sober a little while, then I went out one more time, and then I came in when I was 25, and then I stayed sober. I stayed sober for the next 6 years with some of my friends in the 11-step group. Tommy's here. A bunch of my friends are here from the 11-step group. And I did have a life beyond my wildest dreams. I did have a life that Alcoholics Anonymous promised me. But I didn't really have a personal relationship with God. I had a personal relationship with my fellows, and I loved you guys. And I met my beautiful wife, and we had an AA wedding. But I didn't have a personal relationship with the God of my understanding. I kind of picked your God. And when I would pray in the morning and I would give God 5 minutes, you know, my brother Jerry says, I used to chintz God. That's what I used to do. I used to give him 5 minutes. I wouldn't even give him 5 minutes. I'd give my teeth more than I would give God. I'd brush my teeth longer than I would pray. I'd give him like a New York 5 minutes, which is like 30 seconds. And for 6.5 years, I'd say to God, please keep me sober. Take away the desire for me to use drugs and alcohol. Help me to help somebody else. And that's the last time I spoke to him till the end of the day. And let me tell you, when you have alcoholism, the reason that I drank and drug is because I have something inside me that's restless, irritable, and discontent. And when I took a drink, at once, like Fred Z said today, at once, I used to get the feeling of ease and comfort that came over me. And it worked perfectly for me. I was always running around like a little Tasmanian devil. So the first time I took a drink and then boom, I felt ease and comfort. And I took a breath and it was like, wow. I think Gustav talks about it. It's like, wow. And I was looking for that my whole life. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for the first couple years, it was like that for me. You know, because meetings are new and you hear the big book for the first time and you're like, wow, that's unbelievable. You see the 12 steps and, you know, I wasn't one of these guys that balked because God was in there. I thought, yeah, God's cool. I mean, there's no problem with me and God. Higher power, a God of my own, whatever. It was all fine. And plus, I was in AA when I was 23, 24, and in NA. And in NA and in AA, when you're 23 and you're 24, I mean, that is an amazing, that's like the clubs without alcohol. And I was just having a ball. I was really having a ball. And you guys were looking good. The girls were looking good. And I was looking good. And I was young. And I kind of have a little bit of a shtick, a little bit of a lingo. So I was like in and out of the, you know, what's up? How you doing? Hitting all the halfway houses to see if anybody was, you know, what's new in town. And I used to make the halfway house circuit all up until my 3rd year of sobriety. I would hit the halfway. And then someone said to me, you know, you got 3 years now. It's probably better you don't date people under 6 months. I never even heard of something like that. And then, of course, I met my wife and straightened up right there. I was happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was happy in the 11-step group. I believed everything that you guys were telling me. And I used to introduce myself as an alcoholic. My name is Stevie B and I'm an alcoholic, but I never, ever believed for 1 second I was an alcoholic, never once. But because I was an Alcoholics Anonymous and because of singleness of purpose and I didn't want to introduce myself as an addict, alcoholic, and all that nonsense, I used to introduce myself as an alcoholic, but never, ever, ever did I believe I was an alcoholic. And if you take a look over my life, and if you take a look over my story, I never had an alcohol problem, never. I always had a drug problem. And what got me into Alcoholics Anonymous is drugs. And what brought me to my knees is drugs. And what brought me into the streets is drugs. And what crushed my families is drugs. So for years, I would be inside our 11-step group, and I would say, my name is Stevie B, and I'm an alcoholic. And then I would say to myself, but not really. I just want to be part of, and I don't want to be singled out, and I want to fit in. But I never thought I had a problem with drugs. And always, I felt that I could have a drink with impunity. Always. I just knew that it's a possibility, a small possibility, that if I took a drink, it could bring me back to drugs. So I didn't. But in my 5th year of sobriety, I went to my home group and I said, listen, I don't think I'm an alcoholic and I think I'm going to try some controlled drinking. And then I went home and told my wife, and she didn't think it was a good idea, and my parents didn't think it was a good idea. And my home group, they all talked me out of it, and LaDonna and John and all of them converged on me, and they're like, they 12-stepped me, and I wasn't even drinking, they 12-stepped me. And they convinced me that it's probably better that I wouldn't drink. But for 2 years, I thought about taking a drink. And I was smoking cigars at the time, and I was reading this magazine called Cigar Aficionado. And those guys in the thing, they had this snifter of brandy in their hand, and they had this big stogie. And I saw myself as one of those guys, a snifter in the hand and a stogie type of guy, like a mahogany desk with an attaché case. And I thought to myself, I'm an attaché case. I worked in the swap shop, but I figured, you know what, I could carry an attaché case. You know, maybe do a snifter of brandy. I didn't even know what a snifter was, but I saw them and I saw myself puffing a cigar and I saw myself as kind of an aristocratic and I thought to myself, I can have a glass of wine. And for 2 years, because all action is born in thought, for 2 years I thought about it. And I romanticized it. And we were on our honeymoon, and the table next to us, we're in Emeril Lagasse's restaurant. And I just got married to the woman of my dreams. And we're eating fine dining food. But there was something missing for me, and really was a fine glass of wine. And I looked over at the table next to me, and they were doing this wine presentation where they pour out the wine into a decanter and they let it breathe. I had no idea what that means, but that's what they were doing. They were letting the wine breathe, and the people were talking about how the wine was breathing, and they weren't drinking it, and I'm like, I could drink wine that needs to breathe. I can do that. I mean, who could get hooked on something like that? And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I thought about it. And I picked up my 7-year medallion at the 11th Step Group, and I decided I was going to have one glass of Japanese rice wine, Japanese sake wine, a little tiny glass like that. I'm 240 pounds. I didn't think that little tiny glass would have any effect in my life. And I never had a problem with alcohol. And I took that shot, and it went down my system, and the day before I was in AA, that day I picked up my medallion, that moment, it was like I was never in AA before. It was like that. It was like, I was in, I was out. I understood what you were talking about. I didn't even understand what you were talking about. The 12 steps made sense. I thought you were ridiculous. I used to go to because my only friends were in Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to go to the 11 step group and I used to pity them. I'm like, these poor fools, they can't drink. But I'm drinking on the side. I'm going to the meetings and I'm drinking and I'm having a good life. And now I'm taking some Xanax and other things while I'm going to the meetings and I'm having a great time. I'm my shares are better. I'm more at ease. I'm not taking other people's inventory. I'm relaxed. You know, the same people that were annoying me the year before, I'm like, that guy had a good story tonight. Yeah. Felt great, you know, shaking it off. I felt good going to the gym because I wasn't going to as many meetings. I was only going to one meeting, the 11 Step Group. Now I have so much time to go to the gym, and I opened up another business, and I was looking good, and my pants were tighter. It was just fantastic life. Went to a spa resort with my wife over in the West Coast, and we're working out in the gym and getting massages and walking around in robes and slippers, and we're just having a great life. And then all of a sudden that night, where the company of my wife would have been enough, really what I wanted to have was drinks and not the company of my wife. And all of a sudden I found out what you guys were talking about alcoholism. And all I could think about, now, she wasn't allowing me to drink in the house or in this hotel. It was a health spa resort. You know, I wasn't going to be able to go to the bar. My wife is very serious against drinking, which later on in this experiment, I thought to myself, I really did marry the wrong woman because she is incredibly boring. And so she wasn't allowing me to drink. And so here I am 6 months into the drinking experiment, and all I could do is think about Sanibel Island. How am I going to get drink into my system? And I went to, and I bought all these little airplane bottles, these little tiny airplane bottles. And we're sitting outside there, looking over the bay, and with a private dinner that I ordered on the balcony, and all I could do is think about drinking. I couldn't think about her or the bay or the blessings or about God. All I could do is, how am I going to get the stuff that's in my pocket in my throat? And so I said I wanted to go downstairs, and I took a long elevator ride. And then on my way up, I bought all the stuff and had them in my pocket. And I put my foot up, I put my feet up, and just pretending that I was serene and into God. And I put my feet up, and then all the bottles that I was fell onto the floor. And you hear, kring, 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 kring. And my wife goes, what's that? I go, I don't know. I must have been an alcoholic before us in the room before us. And I said, it came out of the couch. And she was appalled, but she didn't know it was mine. And we collected it, and we, you know, it was just a nightmare. And I found myself obsessing about alcohol. Not drugs. Alcohol. And I found myself stopping at Walgreens and stopping at bars and hiding booze and you know what God did for me that I just can't imagine? He gave me the gift of understanding of alcoholism. See, I always knew I had a problem with drugs, but I never believed I had a problem with alcohol. And I couldn't go through a Saturday night, a Friday night. I couldn't go through most nights without drinking. But my wife set up a rule that we couldn't drink in the house. She's never had a drink in her life. But she said to me, I could have one night of drinking, like a drink in the house. Now that poses an amazing problem, because Because I wanted to respect that one night thing, but it was a long week. You understand? It was a long week. And I was now all of a sudden, and I'm not handy in any way. I don't do projects in the house. I don't know how to fix things. I call people. But all of a sudden, I started to become handy, and I was working in the workshop in my house, you know, fixing stuff. And Tommy had to come after I got sober and fix a lot of the stuff that I had broken. Because what I was doing at the workbench was drinking and snorting and doing all these things and making up these projects. But after a while, Sandy found out, and she couldn't take it anymore. And I started to do substances other than drinking, because drinking for me is never enough. Even though I fell in love with drinking, it wasn't enough. And I started to fall in love with other substances that weren't drinking. And those substances I thought were helping me with my mental breakdown. And I started taking those substances and taking those substances and taking those substances. And I thought that those substances were helping me with my mental breakdown, because I thought that that was my problem. I started losing weight, and I wasn't eating, and I was going days on end and having these incredible ideas on business and finance and how to change our lives. And those always started at midnight, and they always finished at five or 6 o'clock in the morning. I would never have like an intelligent thought during the day. My thoughts always started at midnight. By the time Sandy woke up from sleeping all night, I was like out at all night places shopping for stuff. And I was having manic episodes, and our life unraveled by the seams. My wife left and she went to visit her family in Colombia, and by the time she came back, it was 3 weeks, 9/11 happened, and my father and mother had come down here to try to help me get sober because they knew there was a problem. I had relapsed into my drug of choice. And now I had destroyed my house physically because I thought the police were always in my house, and I was always hiding stuff in the walls. By that, what I mean is I would punch a hole in the wall and then put a picture in front of it. And then when I found out that the police weren't actually in my house, I would find out that the wall was not solid, and all the stuff that I had hidden in the wall that I thought was solid would have to fall to the bottom of the wall. And then I would have to take a hammer and then chisel out the entire wall to get the stuff that was on the bottom. And there's only so many giant pictures you can buy at the flea market before the entire house starts to look like a museum. So I had all these giant pictures, and then I would think that the police were there, and I would hide stuff in the pipes, which then the pipes wouldn't work. And then in the ceiling, and then the ceilings wouldn't work. And then the air conditioning ducts. And then I couldn't put those back together. And then Sandy came home to that. And she called me from the airport, and she said, "I'm home." And I said, "I'll be right down." I hadn't seen her in 4 weeks. And I had so much intention in my heart that I wanted to stop what I was doing inside the house and go pick her up. I so wanted to meet her at Miami Airport to pick her up, and I couldn't stop. And I know I couldn't show up the way that I was, and yet I couldn't stop. And she stood there with her bags, and she waited for her husband, and I couldn't stop. And then my father went and picked her up, and while he went to pick her up, I escaped into the car, and I went and I hid in our photo studio under some cabinets. Because that's the type of fun, alcoholic, atte, shake case, high-end, letting my wine breathe on the decanter type of guy I became. By the way, I got to tell you, I never did get to try any of those wines, because my first night out, I ordered like this $45 bottle of wine, and I went to go drink it, and it tasted terrible. I mean, it was dry and terrible. And I said, "You know what? Give me some Mad Dog 2020, because I love Mad Dog 2020. I love Mad Dog 2020, and I'm half Jewish, so I was like Manischewitz and Mad Dog 2020, so I was having a ball. I never got to be a fine wine drinker. I was a Muscatel type of drinker, so I just wanted to let you guys know that. So I couldn't stop. And I wanted to stop. And so my wife intervened and my family intervened, and they put me in a treatment center, and I stayed in the treatment center for 7 weeks, and I couldn't stop. And then they put me in a detox, and I couldn't stop. And I got out of the detox, and I relapsed again, and my heart was broken. And then finally, the last thing, when they just couldn't have any more of me, they put me in a halfway house. And my wife served me with a restraining order. And she said, "Listen, we are through. As long as you don't call me, as long as you don't break the violation of this restraining order, I'll pay for the halfway house for you." And she did. And I went to Liberty House around the corner from here. And that's where I met Mason and Eddie. They were my roommates. And Eddie and I went to Victory that day, not knowing that we were going to be roommates at a halfway house later on that day. And we both sit at Victory, sitting next to each other, picking up our medallions, which we're going to be picking up 9 years pretty soon. And then we went home that night, and we found out we lived together in the same room, but he was very noisy, so we slept in separate rooms. And I got a start, you know what I mean? And I called this guy, Jerry, from New York, and I said, Jerry, I need you to be my sponsor again. You're the toughest guy I know. He's this tough Jew from Manhattan, and he was tough, he's small, he's tough, and he doesn't take nothing from nobody. And I said, Jerry, I need the toughest sponsor. You're the toughest guy I know. And he had like 6 years of gritty sobriety, you know, he's like, he was tough. And he said, yeah, I'll sponsor you, Stevie, but what you're going to start today is you're going to start to get on your knees in the morning again. And you're going to start at night, you're going to get on your knees. And I wasn't into that at that point in my sobriety. I was living with Mason and Eddie, and that's not what I had in mind, the getting on my knees and praying sobriety thing again. I tried that. It didn't work. And first of all, I knew he was Jewish, and I'm Catholic, so I tell him like this, Jerry, Catholics don't get on their knees, other than church. It's kind of an anti-religious thing for us. I figured I'd throw the religion trump card at him, you know? And Jerry says to me, listen, Stevie, if you want to stay sober, you're going to get on your knees in the morning and you're going to ask God to keep you clean and sober. And if you want to stay sober, you're going to thank him at night. Because he told me a story, and I know a lot of you guys heard this story, but I always got to tell it to you because it was the turning point in my life. He explained to me that if he invited me over for dinner and I came to his house and I was grabbing food off the table and I was eating it and shoving it down my throat and I wasn't saying please, and then I left that table and left that house, and I didn't say thank you, I would never be invited back again, would you? And I said, no, Jerry. He said, so why should you be in God's world one day without saying please, and at the end of the day, if you make it through the day without saying thank you? And it made sense to me, because I like food. And I wanted to be invited back to the table of sobriety. And from that day, I started getting on my knees in the halfway house, no matter what those guys thought. And they might have been getting on their knees too, I don't know. And I started to develop some type of God consciousness, not exactly knowing what it was, but knowing that I didn't want to drink again. And about 30 days into the experiment of getting on my knees in the morning, I wanted to take a day off because I was already sober 30 days. And when you're sober 30 days and you're living in a halfway house, sometimes you feel like you could get a little reward. And the only reward that I have ever known on how to give myself a little reward is a little, you know, snippy snip. So I didn't really want to relapse. I didn't really want to go out, but I just wanted to have like a day off from sobriety. I had been putting in 30 hard days of sobriety, going to meetings and going to work and then meetings and then praying on my knees. I mean, it was a lot of work. So I decided I wanted to get high one more time. And I called up Sandy and I asked her, I said, sweetheart, I know I'm not supposed to call you, but if you could give me $199 and put it on that money card you gave me, I want to get a special phone at the Sprint store, one that could hold a lot of numbers from AA. And then I could use that phone and I could be more in AA. And any time I would ever give her that type of line, she would have just gave me the money. Because Sandy doesn't know anything about the disease, I thought. But what happened is I was out of the house for 4 months and Sandy joined Al-Anon. Yeah, some of you guys might have heard of it. Yeah. And so she called up her sponsor and her sponsor said, give the bum the money. Let's find out if he's a liar, a cheat, and a thief right now. And they give me the money. And I run over to the Sprint store. And I want to tell you something, brothers. This is about 6 years ago, I was sitting in this meeting and I thought to myself, if I could ever speak in this meeting, man, that would be all I want, God. That would be all I want. And so far for the last 5 years, I don't know how this happened, and maybe I'm going to say it out loud and it's never going to happen again, Ron, but I don't know, but I want to tell you what's happened to me. Somehow for the last 5 years, they've asked me 2 times a year for the last 5 years. And every time before I speak here, we go to the place I'm about to tell you. You see, I run into the Sprint store, And I'm like jonesing, because you know in like 15 minutes I know what's about to happen. So my face is all contorted, my stomach is moving, I'm sweating, I'm foaming at the mouth. And I tell the guy behind the counter, I need the cheapest cell phone you got. And I need to be out of here like in 15 minutes. And I'm not kidding, like that type of thing. Because I know that if I spend $15 on the cell phone and I have 100 and whatever the math is on that, $185 for the other stuff, that it's very possible that I would be able to buy the cell phone, get high for a little while, go over to that place where they sell those 3-for-1 drinks on Federal Highway, take a nap, brush my teeth, and somehow in my junkie logic, I thought that I could pull one over the guys when they came back to the halfway house. But I had already been praying on my knees for 30 days. And when I walked up to that guy behind the counter, I said, I need that cell phone. I need to be out of here in 15 minutes. Drew from Victory says to me, Stevie B, it's so good to see you. Welcome back. We saw you pick up your under 30 days yesterday. Raise your hand. Welcome back. Would you like to take a cup of coffee? And that Sprint store is right around the corner from him. My wife and I, every single time that I speak here, by the grace of God, we go and we have ourselves something just to remember what it was like when I only had just a couple days. And I was living with Mason. I was living with Eddie, as I told you. And I was it was fun. It was great. And Eddie would cook us meals. And Eddie would talk about God. And Eddie would pray in a different way than I ever prayed. He used to pray in the Lord's name. And we used to hold hands. And he'd be talking about our personal relationship with God. And something was starting to move inside me. And I was praying on my knees, like I said. And then things were moving. And Sandy says to me, why don't you come back and live in the house at 9 months of sobriety? And I go and I move back into the house that night and and Sandy's cooking some eggs or something downstairs, and I smell the coffee, and I had just slept in the big bed for the first time. And I get this great idea to turn the mattress over, because my side was a little bit lumpy. And I turn the mattress over, and there, it turns out that's where I put my drugs and my paraphernalia in a blackout. And I'm looking at my drugs and I'm looking at my paraphernalia. And the grace of God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And for the first time in my life, it wasn't Steve and the drugs. It was Steve and God and the drugs. And he gave me the power at that exact moment to be able to call my wife, scoop up all the stuff, put it in the bag. We were crying. She was crying and I was crying. She was crying because she was relieved. I was crying because I knew I was actually in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew that this was not a fake thing. I was the real deal, because I did something in integrity when nobody was watching. And I got to tell you, the last 8 years has been nothing short of a miracle in my life. Not only did she invite me to come back and live in the house, we've been on AA trips. Mason and I have spoken around the country. We went out to San Francisco. We've had the opportunity to start Bible studies down here. And let me tell you, it's been amazing. And like Eric said, it's been the toughest thing that's ever happened to me, because life is life. And I've lost my grandmother. I've lost my best friend. And we've been through deaths together. And then a couple years ago, and I don't use this for effect, I just have to tell you the lowest point in my life, and I just have to tell you this is what we do anyway, and I'm going to leave it about choices. Sandy and I were pregnant at one time, and we've been trying for years. She finally gets pregnant, and I'm not going to go into the entire story, but we lose the child. And I'm sitting there and I can't believe it, that the doctor says to me that it's not going to happen. I'm almost sitting in a surreal situation, because I know I'm a child of God, and I know I've been doing the right thing, and I know I've been serving God. And it's just not possible. I'm thinking that you must be wrong. Check it again, I say. And she's looking at me and I'm looking at her, and I have all this hate and all this anger comes over me. And I make a decision. I'm not following God. I'm not talking about God. I'm done with the Bible studies. I'm done taking meetings into where Doug was at. I'm done. I'm through with this. And I call up Mason and I say, I'm done. And you know what? Where are we going to go? Who are we going to follow? What's our choice to be? He either is or he isn't. And that night, Sandy was at her Al-Anon meeting, and I was with Doug over at the recovery place. Because, brothers and sisters, this is it for me. This is the only place that's ever given me a shot. It doesn't matter what happens in my life. I'm not crazy about going through difficulties. I'm not crazy about developing perseverance. But what else is the choice to be? I can't sit at home and suck my thumb and whine. I don't have sucking thumb crybaby sobriety. One of the greatest blessings in my life, other than, of course, my relationship with my wife and my Lord and Savior, is with Doug. Where is Doug? I started sponsoring Doug because as a result of God put it in my heart that I wanted to go around to treatment centers and take meetings into treatment centers and let them know that it's okay to love the Lord and it's okay to love AA. And you could love them both. They go together perfectly. And I started going around to these treatment centers, and Doug was in this treatment center, and he came up and asked me to be a sponsor. And Doug didn't look like the Doug that he looked like today. He was all disheveled and had farmer hair, and he was all wacky. And I thought to myself, this old guy is not going to be able to take my type of sponsorship. And I said to him, I ain't taking no weak-willed sponsors. You got to be a tough guy. Little did I know he was a farmer and raised a family, and you can fix a tractor with a toothpick. I mean, he's one of those guys. And he has become, along with the men inside this room, he has become one of my closest friends today. And I just so appreciate that he asked me to speak tonight. Thanks so much for letting me share.
Thank Eric and Steve one more time, please.